I was running to a future that I was hoping to write like the ground under my feet. I used 8 years old as the demarcation line for like a type of consciousness, but also I remember visiting my father every summer. And around the time that I turned 12, my father had bought a book called Mel Bay's How to Play Bluegrass Mandolin. And out of a book began teaching himself with an old gourdback, taterbug mandolin, how to play mandolin. And really, it's just like painting by numbers. The book says you put your first finger on one of four frets, on one of four strings, and you play this chord. And my father, being a very hyper-rational, born-again atheist, Catholic-damaged, baby boomer, was in his library. My father actually had a library in the house that he had built. And having had been a history and English major in college, went into teaching. So while he was teaching himself to play mandolin, he was also building in his backyard a boat from books. He was teaching himself how to build a boat from books. But my father, that summer that I was 12, in his library was kind of, in a way, a father does best. Not lecturing, not instructing, but just, I think what he did was he was sharing his own conclusions. And that invited me as a 12-year-old, before I was all fired up with hormones to be like rejecting everything he was saying, absorbing all of this influence and inspiration. And so what he was outlining for me in his very hyper-rational way was all the reasons that playing music is a beneficial thing to be doing. And I must have in my 12-year-old brain been taking mental notes. It lets you make a living. It lets you travel. It lets you meet people. All of these things. And my mother, back in East Texas, had an old dusty guitar in the corner. And I remember not long after that coming across a Judy Collins songbook. And it had those same tablature chord patterns. Almost from the minute that I learned G, C, and D from the Judy Collins songbook, I started writing songs. And the reason I started writing songs wasn't because I had a lot to say. It was because that way no one could tell me that I was singing the song wrong. Although I know my love for you is true, I seem to bring out the very worst in you. Perhaps you thought my love could be bought. Perhaps you think we're happy, but we're not. I try to talk it out, but you just take it out on me. Shout at me to shut up, turn the volume up on the TV. When the neighbors all began to complain, you yell at me and tell me it's my treachery's to blame. I gave you my trust, but I'm taking back the same for the things you are doing in our name. All I ever needed you to show me was your soul, to see that all you ever really wanted was control. Now I know this wasn't part of your plan. I'm saying this, citizen to country, not woman to man. I believe we should see other people. I believe with all my heart that we should start to see other people. We should see other people. I believe we should see other people. I believe with all my heart that we should start to see other people. All I ever needed you.
soul. I see that all you ever really wanted was control. Now I know this wasn't part of your plan. I'm saying this, citizen, the country, not woman, man. I believe we should see other people. I believe with all my heart that we should start to see other people. We should see other people. I believe we should see other people. I believe with all my heart that we should start to see other people.
I didn't care about owning property. I didn't care about material things. I cared about adventure. I cared about good stories. And along the way, when Jim Squatter told me, "You're an anarchist, dear," I cared about making trouble. It probably is a corollary to you can be poor anywhere, is that you can make trouble anywhere. And so in the pursuit of like squatting culture in Amsterdam, for example, I got to be educated basically by a lot of European anarchist traditions that had somehow managed to evade the, you know, the history that I had gotten in the U.S. Growing up, that's all I ever heard about. Oh, you missed it. It all happened in the 60s. But, you know, getting to experience the birth of punk rock, getting to experience the birth of hip hop and the blending of those two, because with Rock Against Racism, they were bringing both of those cultures together. The way the hippies told their story was kind of corny, that if it had really had value, it would have lasted. But to give them some kind of acknowledgement, in San Francisco, when I wrote Fogtown, I was in a milieu that very proudly included beatniks, hippies, and punks. In New York, it's June, July, August, September 1986, and I'm actively involved in this collective called the Speakeasy. And the Speakeasy was a cooperative or collective of folk singers, singer-songwriters in the West Village. And a friend comes back from Amsterdam with a magazine. I think it was called The Source. And in the magazine was a flexi disc. And the flexi disc was a recording of a song by a woman named Michelle Schacht. And I'm like, ah, I'm Michelle Schacht. But the song on the flexi disc was called Who Cares? And I'm like, I don't have a song called Who Cares? So we ripped the flexi disc out of the magazine, took it over to her house where she had a turntable, and we put it on the turntable, and I heard what sort of sounded like my voice, but a little bit higher because, you know, when you play tape back on Walkman that has weak batteries, you sound like this. Anyways, it was me going, this is my most recent song, and it's called Oh, Who Cares? And that's how I found out that I had not just a record of a song, but a few weeks later, a letter came in the mail from a man named Pete Lawrence. He was saying, hey, remember in May when I came to Kerrville and I saw you playing at the campfire and I asked if you would mind singing some songs into my Sony Walkman? Well, you'll never guess what happened. In the letter, he explained to me that he had, you know, played it for his editors at this magazine. He told me he was a journalist for this magazine called Folk Roots. And they encouraged him to play it for a friend of his who was a DJ at the BBC. He played it for Andy Kershaw, and Andy Kershaw said, this is fantastic. We should play this on the air. They played it on the air, and the reaction to the broadcast was so great that we decided to put it out as a record. So what do you say? And I think the way the letter said it didn't give away that they had already put it out as a record. I think it was kind of framed as like, what do you think of this idea? He had a label called Cooking Vinyl. They had put out one release by a band called the Oyster Band, and this was their second release. And Andy Kershaw had also started a label and released a recording called the Boardwalk Tapes. And the Boardwalk Tapes was by a soul singer named Ted Hawkins. And Ted Hawkins used to sing on the Venice Boardwalk. And Andy Kershaw had gone with his tape recorder and recorded Ted Hawkins singing on the boardwalk and then played it on his program on the BBC and released it on his label and then brought Ted Hawkins over around the same time as the Texas Campfire tapes had been released. And so there was like this little cultural ripple of like, you know, recording verite. And then they found out that Ted Hawkins had done 10 years in prison for molesting a child. So they had like a media dilemma. That was the letter from Pete Lawrence going, so what do you say? And I was like, gee whiz, Pete. You know, I wasn't thinking of having a career making records. I mean, I always thought of them as like polyvinyl chloride products. And I didn't really want to contribute to adding more, you know, consumer waste to the planet. But on the other hand, you know, I had been arrested at this protest in San Francisco, spent 3 days in jail only for it to turn up on the back page with my name being announced. That's how I got my name, Michelle Schacht. So, you know, maybe there's a way to square this circle by putting out records and using it as a vehicle for my political message.